open my eyes that I may see glimpses of truth I ask for me. Open my eyes, illumine me, Spirit Divine.
Welcome to New Realities. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I present a new paradigm of thinking, a new way of looking at the world. And tonight's guest is very much in alignment with that. She is the author of Gateway to the Heavens, How Simple Shapes Mold Reality and Fabricate Your Being. Her name is Karen French, and I had a nice talk with her this afternoon. And tonight I think we'll talk about her understanding of dimensions. Karen, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yes, I mean, I was learning a lot by just listening to you. Define the, in a way, the evolution of consciousness and space, but specifically, let's talk tonight about what we mean by dimensions, because it's such a new age word. Everyone talks about being interdimensional, multidimensional, and they really, in a way, don't know what they're talking about, do they?
Yes, I think it all revolves around the overuse of the word dimensions for a beginning, because literally, dimensions mean a measurement of something, and so it just gets loosely applied all over the place, and I think that's really one of the reasons why it causes so much confusion.
Well, the way people use it these days, it sort of means, well, how I understand, and actually how I use it, I'm one of those people, it means a sort of state of consciousness. To be a multidimensional person means you can exist in many ways of thinking or many levels of consciousness, but does that make sense to you from a from the place you're coming from?
Yes, from the way I'm coming from, I'm looking at it a very logical point of view. Just to clarify, because if you look at something very logically, then you're all singing off the same song sheet. My area, as you know, is geometry and what shapes and patterns mean in space, and how our reality is organized using these various structures and what they mean. And each shape represents one facet of reality, and by looking at that shape, you can understand it better. So, for example, circles are to do with time and squares are to do with space. And triangles have to do with the nature of your being and who you are. When you look at reality in that way, from my perspective, what you do when you look at the word dimensions and apply them, you are looking at the way that you measure space, for example. So how do we measure space? You measure it by length, breadth, width, that type of thing.
Right.
How do we measure time? We measure time in terms of past, present, future, duration, such as eons, minutes, seconds. And how do we measure perception of being? And that is sentience. How much you perceive? Are you a rock? How much sentience would a rock have versus a human being? Versus another type of being, which might be a much higher awareness, who can perceive far more. The confusion arises when you look at geometry in particular, because you're delving into the world of things like physics. So you have Einstein's theories, you know, that there are three dimensions of space and one of time. So there you have another word, use of the word dimension, which is similar to your definition of dimension, where as a multidimensional person you have very many facets to who you are and what you can see. But then you get the dimensions, again going back to physics, the dimensions of, for example, string theory at a quantum level, and then there the theorists talk about 11 dimensions, 9 of which are sort of string-like things that loop together, and the 10th being time. So, and then you get people talking about dimensions or planes of being, you know, etheric realms, and how there are the grosser levels, you know, the various sheaths on our bodies extending out to angelic realms and definitions of God. So this is where the word dimension starts to get very clouded and fuzzy when it's applied to all these different types of areas or definitions of what time and space and being are all about.
Right.
So right. I try to stick to the logical definition. A dimension is a measurement. So let's look at the different facets of reality and how you would measure those. Before I move on, there's another question.
No, the facets of reality. The only thing, the question I have is when you mentioned being and sentience, and in a way, that's quite a subjective measurement in a way, or qualification. Some people would argue that it's so subjective you can't really talk about someone else's sentience as objective qualities. Mm. Yeah.
It is, because other facets of measurements of being might be, absolutely. What type of being are we as well? You know, are we a human being or are we an alien being? You know, the whole area of what being is, what it is to be, is probably the most subjective area of all of it. But then you could argue that time is fairly subjective as well. So what is time and the measurement of time, and who defined a minute? Who decided how long a minute was and labeled it? And measurements of width and breadth and things like that.
But let's go along and continue where you're heading, because I think you're onto quite an original way of thinking about it. So we can put that aside, that sort of discussion, and proceed to where you were heading.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I started heading and looking at this was, well, just how many measurements are there of? Because if you start to say, well, there are three measurements of space, you know, length, breadth, width, and depth, and then there's time. Well, that seems very limiting. Then you've got, obviously, string theory, which goes on about 9, 10, 11. Every time there's some kind of research into some sort of area of reality, the numbers of dimensions seem to just keep being added to. And then I have conversations with people who say, well, I can perceive 50 dimensions, or I can see 10 dimensions, and then what about the other definition of dimensions, which are other universes that are sort of running parallel to ours and things like that? So it got me thinking, well, just how many dimensions might there actually be?
Right.
And because they just seem to be accumulating very rapidly. And so I sort of looked at it from the point of view of how numbers work and shapes work, and in particular the numbers 0 to 10, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and the beginning, 0, 1, and the end, 1, 0, in that sequence of events, that sequence string of numbers.
Right.
Because all the numbers between 1 and 10 sort of relate to particular shapes and specific attributes of reality and how they are structured. And by looking at those shapes, we get a sense of the energy and the nature of them. If we go back to the 0, 1, 1, 0, everything in the universe, if there was a zero preceding everything, zero meaning nothing, sort of like a pool of consciousness out of which anything becomes manifest, and that pool of consciousness, that infinite zero, has no form, has no substance, then the number one, or the dot, or the point appears, which is in the middle of that, the I in of perception of I am whatever, the point in all potential here-ness, all potential space, and the moment, the infinitely small moment, which is in all possible events in time. So you have the I am here now in the middle of all possibility.
Can I ask you one question about that? How does, and it might be an impossible question to answer, but how does something come from nothing?
How does that point appear?
Yeah.
Well, if I knew the answer to that, I mean, I is it there all the time? Is it never not there? Is it instantaneously appearing as it vanishes somewhere else? This was one of the things with the Tai Chi symbol, the yin-yang representation that everybody knows from Asia, where you have the black dot and the white dot within their opposite. That is within a circle, and the point of that is to say, well, these things are always here. They're never not here. So as soon as there's the dot, and it's an instantaneous event, the point of the infinite pool, or Wu Qi as the Taoists call it, where there is no... no dot in the middle, does that state ever manifest, or is it always the case that the universes are being created and destroyed in beginning and ending instantaneously? And that's the point I was actually getting to, because that dot in the middle is the exact opposite of the 10 at the end, the 1 and the 0 at the end. And when you have the 0 and then the 1 appearing, you setting off a sequence of events. And at the end, when the zero comes after the one, it can become 1000000. So you have infinite number of possibilities.
Right.
And the numbers in between just define characteristics of reality, which allow us to perceive that that we are here as a human being wandering around in space doing whatever we might do. So you could argue that there's actually an infinite number of dimensions of time and space and whatever, because that's what the one and the zero facilitate. Just like we can create an infinite number of computer programs on the computer, different realities, different ways of looking at things, different pictures, images, Word documents, you know. The one and the zero facilitate an infinite number of possibilities.
Right, but a one and a zero is everything, right? Yes,
mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So, okay, so what do we do with that? And then let's keep moving into this dimensions. I mean,
mm-hmm.
could you connect it to consciousness and reality as we move along? I guess you are, in a way.
Yes, it is. The conscious, if you have this pool of consciousness and all possibilities and then the one appears, what happens to it then? You know, one becomes two, it's one plus one, and the second one is a reflection of the first one, is sort of, you have the active one and the passive one. One combining with two, one plus two creates three, which is the triangle, and the third one is the offspring or the parents. Four is slightly different because it's two plus two. So you have this doubling effect, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32. So from the one you have this sort of various numbers between the sort of 1 and 10 again, sort of being created, being facilitated. Now consciousness, what is consciousness for a start? I mean, that's the huge question, because nobody knows what it is. Even though there are books written about, nobody actually knows what consciousness is and how out of that reality really becomes manifest. I mean, that's the sort of $10 million question. But I view the fact that numbers and shapes are like these coat hangers, structures, molds that consciousness can use to come into this reality that we know, this three-dimensional reality here, to allow us to experience the idea of time and space and combining, to allow us to move around in time and space, for events to play out, for us to assume different forms of being, different degrees of sentience, and to experience what those are like. And that passage of time and the experience of what space is, spatial dimensions, time dimensions. I don't actually use the word illusion, because again, that's another overused word, but it is just facilitated, that experience is facilitated by these numbers and shapes. But if you start to delve down, as we do in physics, as we do through connecting into different realms of being, what substance is there beyond that? The sort of three-dimensional world is a very unusual one. The word dimension, we typically start to look at, well, what are bigger dimensions? Because you have three dimensions of space, then you have fourth dimension of space-time, which is the toroidal hypercube. Then you have the fifth dimension, which people speculate to be a ring donut shape.
Okay. Yeah, let's break those down. Okay, I think everyone sort of gets the idea of three dimensions. But when you talk about hypercubes, that's something I've been trying to understand, get my head around.
To get your head around it, it starts to get tricky because it's a bit like maps, okay? When you have one dimension, that's a line. Two dimensions is a bit like a map that we would roll out and have a look at.
Now, a plane. A flat sheet of paper.
Yeah, and you can look at this map just as we look at things like mandalas or a painting on the wall, okay? Those are sort of representations of reality. They're sort of a snapshot of it. So the two-dimensional one, even though it's two-dimensional, it's still part of the same reality, but it's flat. So you can only look at it from one perspective. You know, it doesn't give you a complete picture of what reality is all about. You can still get a sense of it. Right? And this is where consciousness is really funny, because consciousness, if you tune into it, you can get an awful lot of information and energy coming off a two-dimensional representation. But a two-dimensional representation, for example, the circle with a dot in it, is a representation of an infinitely large sphere with an infinitely small dot in the middle. But anyway, so you have your map, and you look at
it. Okay, your map, which is two dimensions.
Your map is two-dimensional.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
So then your three-dimensional world is a next step beyond that map, actually being able to walk around in it. So you can see on the map that there are hills and there are rivers and everything, but you can't actually get into them. You have to get into three dimensions to actually experience that. Four dimensions takes you beyond that even more, into another energetic level of what those hills and those mountains and everything else look like and sense like. But because our consciousness is in this three-dimensional world, it's very difficult for us to perceive upwards and beyond that, and to actually represent what that would look like, because our eyes see things in a three-dimensional way. And
well, they have things like hypercubes, which is a representation of a fourth-dimensional object. But can you describe what a hypercube is, and then we can go on to the n-dimensional geometries as well. But
the hypercube, is like a shadow reflection of a level above us, and it looks like somebody's flattened, squashed a donut that would have edges to it, lots of lines and planes to it. Somebody's gone and squished it in some way, and it's very difficult to describe. It's something, you know, visually it's quite complicated to see. What is interesting is the next step beyond the hypercube, because that is easier for people to understand, and that is the ring donut. So it's a bit like donuts with a hole in the middle,
like a double toro, the torus.
The toroidal ring. Yes. So
is that a fourth dimensional object?
That's the fifth dimensional object. That's the next step beyond. Yeah.
And do you know anything about N dimensional geometry? As my producer Seth wants to ask you about N dimensional space.
Well, you're getting into quite complicated mathematical things there, and I try to steer clear of that type of thing because it really just confuses people.
Okay. And let's go back to fourth dimension. I mean, is that just a kind of mental exercise, or is there actually a reality to it that we could see in the real world?
Well, we're sort of like st- stuck in the middle of it. I don't think, you know, you can't actually see it, perceive it. What I find incredible is that the human brain has the capacity to think of that, much as we have the capacity to think about, because that dimension is getting bigger, if you know what I mean. We're sort of working upwards.
We're working up towards the fourth dimension, you're saying?
Yes, because you're going naught dimensions, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. You're looking up, you're expanding the scope. So you're going from a map to a three-dimensional world to a fourth. So do you see how you're adding more information?
Mm-hmm.
You're adding more experience, if you can see what I mean?
Well, I can see what you mean when we go from two dimensions to three dimensions. And some people say the nonlinear aspect of consciousness actually exists as a fourth-dimensional vehicle, let's say, because it transcends time and space.
Okay, so that's exactly it. It's sort of what you're doing is your scope for complexity within the reality is expanding. So when you've got a flat plane, you can only move around in a flat way. When you've got three, you can move away around three dimensionally. So you're expanding the scope of moving around in space and moving around in time, and maybe it becomes more and more intangible. Okay? So what we're doing is we're sort of making our reality more and more experiential in that way. But this is just one way of looking at dimensions, and it's a combined dimension of space and time that we're discussing here. Because bear in mind, there are also other people who are talking about dimensions where you're getting smaller. This is where the quantum physicists. So they're saying, okay, let's look down at things. Let's look smaller. So you have matter. What is there? What's the molecule made out of? And what's down below, you know, further than that? And that's where things like string theory come in. And they talk about dimensions as well in terms of what matter is comprised of. Mm-hmm. So things like the toroidal hexagram and the donut, they're all looking at the structure of the universe on a sort of larger scale. Then you have the quantum physicists going down on a smaller scale. So can you see what I'm saying? This is where the word dimension gets very confusing, because it's applied
It does, but time must come involved. I mean, like all the physicists talk about the notion of time, that must, I mean, have a dimensional aspect. And also, I think we're only seeing time as a one-dimensional thing, where time probably, like space, might have more than one component. The way space has three components to it, time may have three or more.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
So how does that fit into what you're talking about, or does it?
Well, it does, but this is where a lot of these models get very complicated to comprehend, because time and space are sort of work together seamlessly. You can't sort of slice one off from the other. And the nature of time and what time does is very different to space, even though they work together. You know, the space-time, and they're sort of linked in. And that's why I started to think of dimensions as measurements of aspects of being, and I call the aspects space, and how space is can be understood using the square, and time using the circle. And I said, okay, well, let's look at what measurements of a space, and how do we measure it, and then let's look at time. And as you say, nobody really looks at time separately and considers the measurements of time. And as you say, what are those components? So they're things like the past, present, and future. How do those break up? Are they there at the same instantaneous moment? How does the moment fit into it? Are there other times running parallel to ours going at different speeds? Things like this.
Exactly. And then it may be that there are. I mean, there may be. So, a fourth dimensional hypercube would exist from what I've seen as a, well, the third dimension then would be a shadow in the way of the fourth dimension. It's a shadow. So let's say we are also existing in a fourth dimensional space on some level.
Yes.
Right. So what would the fifth dimension be if somewhere we also have, I mean, we can describe it with those double toroidal shapes, but how would we actually exist there if we are, and maybe we are?
Well, this is the interesting thing, because just looking at the representation of the fifth dimensional thing, the way that it's sort of described, it's like a donut, where the top of the donut is, there are, on each side there's a black hole and a white hole, so things are going in one end and coming out the other. And this goes back to the idea that the Tai Chi symbol almost sums that up, this continual state where things are being created and destroyed instantaneously, where the white light is going in one side and coming out the other. And it's sort of going round in a spiraling motion. There's this, it's quite difficult to describe. There's some wonderful graphics on one internet site that I've seen, where it's sort of, you know how in the Tai Chi symbol there's this S symbol? The S?
Yes.
This transformation of one condition to the other. There's this sort of coexistence of opposites, where one can become the other instantaneously, and they're sort of existing in this very tenuous state, tension.
Right.
And
right.
Within the toroidal hexagram, this sort of S business is going round and round and round and round and round and round the donut, keeping it in this state of equilibrium of creation and destruction that's sort of going on. And in between those conditions is us in there somewhere down below this three-dimensional world. So at the beginning you have the naught and the one, and at the end you have the one and the zero. And the toroidal hexagram is a super reflection, of, if you like, of that condition. Does that
Well, I think you're sort of losing me somewhere in there. But is there a way to experience? Because I think we can draw pictures and do all that, but...
How do you experience it? I think possibly, and if we're into meditation, I think if you were to have the Tai Chi symbol and to reflect on that, but think of it not as two-dimensional, but as multi-dimensional, not just representing duality, but putting it in your mind's eye that this represents the fifth dimension, it might be an interesting experience. Because the Tai Chi symbol is a bit like the toroid concept, flattened out. So you take one side and you pull it out and you flatten it. So if you were to fold the Tai Chi symbol in half, where the white dot was on the top and the black dot was on the bottom, and inflate it like a balloon, then you'd have the donut idea.
I see.
So you could, if you were to reflect on that and meditate on that, it might be quite an interesting experience. But otherwise, how we perceive it here, I think it would have to be in something which... It's one of those intangible things which just comes to you. It has no substance. You can't, because it's just a shadow. It's one of those things you're aware of, but you can't grasp.
Yeah. It's like consciousness itself, in a way.
It is, yes. Yeah.
I mean, I think your title of your book, Gateways to the Heavens, because it's about the fabric of being, and being, in a sense, is omnidimensional.
Yeah.
Isn't it? So when you say gate... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it's an interesting one, because I read an interesting article the other day about the holographic universe and holographic souls. And this this issue we have in our minds of the fact that we're all individuals and that consciousness is divided up into all sorts of beings, all experiencing reality, and yet we're all connected to the one, and the one consciousness, the one source. And the mm-hmm. idea that we're all just fragments of that. We're all experiencing reality. We're looking at reality from our different eyes and sensing it with our bodies. But in a sense, we're all originating from the same source. So we're all just contributing this experience to one thing. So if you know what I mean. Sorry,
yeah, but I know. I'm just thinking, are we all originating from the same source? And do we know that for sure? I mean, if we could... I mean, because if we know that we are all originating from the same source, if we have that sort of a, I would call it a psychic agreement, that or not even an agreement, a knowing that we are, then that actually proves the argument that we are all original. But there's always a sort of a level of doubt, at least for me, say, am I making this up? Is it real? Is it? Are we truly all on the same page? I mean, am I truly understanding or feeling someone else's level of consciousness? But then I think that's the part that separates us. That's the one that separates us from the zero, which is the totality of connection. So I think consciousness keeps up. Shifting between the one and the many, in a sense, you know?
Yes, indeed. And it goes back to your original point about when does that one appear?
Yeah.
It, you know, and how does it appear? And when does that
and yet
sense...
Yeah, go ahead.
And
no, go
sense,
ahead. What
yeah, because as soon as one, you know, it's the same as the concept of I am. Just the word I, which is, again, a sort of looks like a one. Mm. I am. Then you add all these things on the end, human, female, American, British or whatever, tall, short, dark. You know, all these other words start to be added on. But at the end of the day, you just are. You know, all you have is I am. You have I am, and I have an I am as well.
Right, but your I am and my am are actually... the same, but they're sort of different also, because you're not me, but yet your I am-ness is, I would guess, is the same as my I am being-ness.
Yes, it is. And some you get a sense of that when you look at another person, because I see you, but I don't actually see you, because all I'm seeing is electrons firing in my head that get a sense of, well, there's some colours there, and but I don't actually, you know, what am I actually seeing? All I'm seeing is an image.
Right, but this is where I think the new science or the new science of consciousness supersedes this kind of... mathematical equation for existence. I mean, I think in a sense, truly you are seeing me, but it's on a, let's call it a psychic level.
Mm.
You know, yes, it's just images out there, but the sense, the knowing sense that you are seeing what you're seeing supersedes the breakdown of the scientific way it could be explained.
I think you get a truer feeling of that when you actually look into somebody's eyes.
Yes.
You know what I mean? That's when you make a connection. Yeah.
No, but I'm just curious. Is there some kind of mathematical or geometric way of expressing this sense of when you say I am and I say I am, it means it's exactly the same thing, but actually totally different, because you're you and you and I'm me, but yet it's also the same. So it's in a way it's a paradox of consciousness, but yet there's something beyond that. So do you know what I'm asking?
Oh, I do. I do know what you're asking.
Okay, good. So we're there. It just proves the argument in a sense.
Oh, it is. I mean, it's.
But is there a way of expressing that in number? And if we could express that in number, wouldn't that be a way of proving the existence of spirituality or spirit or consciousness itself?
Well, I mean, it boils down to how do you prove anything? Because this is one of the things about life, you know, whenever anybody says, well, this is the, you know, it's the theory of quantum physicists, it's this theory of this, my view, my perspective, you know, because whenever we have discussions like this, we're talking about ideas in our own heads. Mm. We're sharing a concept through words, through images, through numbers, through symbols. And through these discussions, you know, we're learning about reality, because in our conversation now, I'm formulating ideas and thinking through things, and it'll be completely different from yours, and because I'm looking at it from a completely different point of view. And this is where consciousness and perception of who you are and how you exist in reality is a fairly unique experience. And I can never really know what you're thinking or how you're experiencing it,
but I disagree, because on some level, what I call the psychic reality,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's a way where you know when you connect with someone that thinking. I think you do. There's a link, there's a kind of harmonic syncing of consciousness where we come into alignment with the other person, and both people know it. There's a...
Oh, I agree with that, where we come into an alignment. And that's where, when I said, as will say to you, this is my view, because this happens with, has happened all the time. It's, you know, with human beings, at some point when we started looking at reality, looking around our surroundings, and we started to see images or have views in our heads, and obviously we wanted to share those with other human beings, and so we developed ways of doing that through representing them through symbols and through ideas and through sounds, through speaking. And there is obviously, we resonate with each other, but we equally get times when people, I might not resonate with you on a view, but I resonate with somebody else, and somebody says, oh yes, I share that image. So which one's the right one?
Maybe there isn't the right one in this way of discussing reality.
But that's why I think with geometric shapes and numbers, people seem to resonate with them, because they're very quite logical. And numbers, you know, shapes, squares are a square, circles are a circle, and it seems to be a fairly consistent thing that people agree on that across, you know, the different cultures, and what they look like and what they mean and what they are and what the numerical side of it is, whereas colours, for example, is not something that necessarily everybody agrees what they mean. There is more inconsistency there. But certainly with numbers and forms. And that's why maybe I'm accepting things that I can't describe adequately to other people and what they mean. Because for me, the idea of duality is something that describes what you're talking about. There's you and there's me. Because you can only get that sense of you and me-ness once you've got the idea of concept of number two eyes, a one and a one.
Right. Well, getting back to this idea of dimensions and your book about shapes,
mm-hmm.
There's a difference between a circle and a sphere in the way they mold reality, right? Can you talk about those differences as we go from a two-dimensional circle to a three-dimensional sphere?
Right, okay. The two-dimensional circle is a representation of three-dimensional sphere, and it is sort of a way for us to draw it, if you like, to understand it, because obviously a circle, we're breaking down a problem, if you like, into simpler components so that we can understand it when we're doing a circle versus a sphere, because a sphere is a much more complicated thing to draw. So if I was to say to you, okay, draw a circle, you'd have no problem doing that, but to draw a sphere, you've got to sort of color in a lot more, do you know, if you see what I mean. So a circle is that two-dimensional map of what a sphere is. It gives you the idea that something's going round and round, but it could be going round and round anywhere of any size. So when I do a circle around myself, I could do a circle around myself in all sorts of different ways. And then, you know, an infinitely large variety of ways I could do the circle around myself. So by looking at the circle, we understand the structure of the sphere. So a circle shows us, for example, that the seasons go around, but no year is ever the same. So within a sphere, the circle could go around in all sorts of different ways so that each year would be different.
Right.
Does that? No, that gets it.
I mean, I was kind of going towards what you were saying. The circle represents a kind of infinite openness, timelessness, dimension. But the sphere somehow doesn't represent that for some reason, because it's then a sphere always seems to exist within a space, which is a square. Do you know what I mean? The circle is somehow more abstract, but a sphere seems limited.
That's interesting, because you could say when you're drawing a circle that there's space inside the circle and space outside the circle.
Yeah.
And a sphere, it depends on what's the circle, whether you put the square inside the circle, the cube, for example, is a three-dimensional square, inside the circle, a sphere, or outside it.
Mm.
But the circle and its three-dimensional sphere is infinitely large.
Mm. Right.
And this is another very difficult concept to get around our heads, that's infinitely large, because I always think, well, if you set off, this is the idea of a circle where you set off and you always come back to the same place that you are. That's the infinitely large sphere, but it doesn't matter which direction you set off, because it's a sphere, you'll still come back. So you could set off to your left, to your right, up, down. You'll always come back to where you are.
But if you use the dimension of time, you never really do come back to where you are. What Heraclitus said, you never step into the same river twice, because
you're in the moment.
Time will have been a key element in distance, and even though it may appear to be the same place, it's sort of different.
So you're stepping in because each moment is different.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So the here also changes as well. Your space time, your point in space has changed because time has moved on. So therefore, everything is different where you are. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just throwing these concepts out there to kind of talk about and speculate and discuss. You know,
they're incredibly complicated ideas to discuss, because they're within everything, and it's how do you convey these ideas? How do you work around them, because the idea of time, if you just take the idea of time, for example, it's an incredibly complicated idea, and how it works and how it affects us and everything. And that's why things like basic shapes are so useful, because they give us a vehicle for expressing what time is about.
How do they do that?
Because,
can you tell me how they... Yeah.
Because by drawing the circle, I'm saying to you, this is my understanding of what eternity is, because it goes round and round and round. It has no beginning and it has no end. And it's something that can be infinitely large and infinitely small. It's a point, which is the moment. So, and then when I make a clock, I make it using a round face, because that, there again, you know, time is going round and round and round. And calendars, like the Mayan calendars, are all based on the circle, or people's star charts and things, because it's a life cycle within the wider cycles of planetary alignments and things like that. So circling, the idea of the circle, is a very useful structure for us to talk about these cycles within other cycles. And then obviously we use the square for space. You know, we put grids on maps and we lay out our houses and things using squares and rectangles to denote areas of space where things, where we go for, you know, eating or whatever, where and the energy of those different locations will change because of what goes on within them. And then squares give us this facility to have some kind of direction. It gives us the idea of, well, there's in front of me and behind of me, and I can move south and east and west. So that's what it gives us, the facility. So they're useful representations of these ideas, which have no bounds, because obviously, because as you said, you have the higher the dimensions, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, the more and more intangible it gets, more and more difficult it is. And using these very tangible symbols, we can actually use them to talk about the ideas, and then to use them as tools, for example, in temple designs or in meditational tools, things like mandalas and things like that.
Well, what's the use of mandala? Can you talk about that use of those types of symbols, those circular symbols, and what they were there for?
Well, they, like a lot of cultures, they go back many thousands of years and were tools, vehicles for contemplation that allowed you to tune into these different facets of reality. They were regarded, and that's where the title of the book came from, Gateway to the Heavens, is actually a translation of Sri Yantra, which is probably the oldest known mandala, which is also known as the mother diagram, out of which other mandalas come from.
The Sri Yantra you're talking about.
Yes, that's right. The Hindu one.
Yes.
And that's known as the mother diagram, yeah.
And the mother diagram? What do you mean by the mother diagram?
Well, it's a bit like the ingredients for cooking. You know, you have the core ingredients, and then you can put together other mandalas, but this is the main one, a bit like the earth is a mother. You know, other things come out of it. Other mandalas can come out of it. It's almost, it's also known, it's like a universal mandala that you can use for anything. Other mandalas are very specific to some kind of specific request or some kind of energy you want to bring into your life. It's a bit like magic, if you like. You can create a mandala because of a particular situation you want to work with, a particular facet of reality. But the Sri Yantra is a very much a universal model. And
how would you work with the Sri Yantra? I'm just curious. Would you stare at it? Would you meditate on that image?
Yes, that's what most people would do, is meditate on it. But in Asia, they build whole temples around it, three-dimensional ones.
What does that do, though? What does that shape do for people who are meditating on or building temples about it?
Well, what they do is, essentially, you have a square, and there are four points that you would enter, and you choose a gate in which you're going to go in. So you'd go, a doorway. So you'd come in from the north, south, east, or west. So you enter the sacred space. So the square is designating, right, I'm going into the sacred space, it's safe, whatever. And you're going in there to experience something. Usually they have circuits, which is represented. The first circuit is the circle within the square. And takes many years of practice, and a lot of people don't, you know, there's a lot of ritual and things associated with these, but you work your way through circuits with the aim of getting to the middle, which is the bindu, which is unity, getting back to unity, to non-duality, if you like, working your way through these rings. Usually there's 9 of them that take you there, and the triangles on the middle are to do with being. It's the cosmic womb and the union of male and female and fertility and those aspects. So you're getting to the core of what time and space and being are all about, and an inner knowingness and a sense of complete awareness, if you like.
So as you incorporate this image into one's being, it sort of unlocks pieces inside our own consciousness that gets in touch with a kind of eternal nature.
That's right. And those particular shapes and that particular combination is actually, some people have found that it's within Stonehenge. If you look at it, you know, you're not necessarily going to have to overtly. It's in all sorts of other temple designs and layouts across other countries as well. It's sort of like a universal diagram, if you like, a universal geometric code that people have been aware of for thousands of years and have built into all sorts of other belief systems as well. Native American medicine wheel, you have the directions north, south, east, west, and you're entering a circle and you're working your way to the middle to get a stronger, you know, an awareness of you and who you are and what your path is and at what point you are in your path and where you need to go and for your personal growth and development.
Well, I love labyrinths for that reason, because they very much, you know, direct us to the center of ourselves as well.
Yes, and that's the same it's the same idea as well, that you're working your way to the middle, getting closer and closer to that.
But when in your title of your book you say Gateway to the Heavens, what are the heavens that you refer to?
Well, this is the levels of being, I think, because obviously that was the translation. My interpretation of that is that there's only one square circle triangle, this one doorway, if you like, this one vehicle for understanding, getting into greater conscious awareness, if you like, of the fabric of what it is to be, and expanding your sentience, expanding your awareness of what reality is. And to do that, you have to work your way up this greater sentience. Is something that is something that you have to do by through meditation, through closing your eyes, because when you're back down here on this level and you open your physical eyes, you're back into the physical world. And heavens in that sense is different layers of being, and it goes back to what you were saying earlier on about how do you perceive these higher dimensions, 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever they might be. And I think it's probably you can gain a sense of that through vehicles like these, meditating on things like these mandalas, such as
these yantras and mandalas give us a sense of our eternal nature in a way.
Exactly, yes, and maybe show us something, you know, give us an insight into some of these other things, some of these questions that we ask.
So this book is called Gateway to the Heavens. Your next book is called Gateways to the Earth, or of the Earth, right?
Gateways of the Earth, yes.
And what do you talk about in that book?
Well, in that book, my first one just looks at the basic shapes and their meaning and purpose, and I look across the different cultures and sciences and arts and show sort of the use of them and how humans have used them to represent these ideas of time and space and how they give us an insight into what it's all about. And the second one, what I do is introduce the elements, the traditional elements like fire and air and water and earth, and also light and sound. So I introduce color and motion and things like that, because it introduces a different facet to the structure, because you're introducing emotional content. And I sort of think about, well, how do these different ingredients combine to allow us to crystallize in this reality, to assume our form? And then obviously on the earth, we have all these various materials that we've used when we've built temples. Why would we build them out of wood or particular stones and things like that? What energy frequencies do these various materials have? What what these temple designs have been all about. So those are the gateways of the earth. It's looking at the earth, ley lines, energy lines, things like that, and the resources that we have used in...
But you're saying in our conversation the other day or today, maybe, that we don't need temples as much as we did before for some reason, right?
No, that's one of the conclusions that I come to at the end of the book is looking at the history and what we've built all of these things. How does that fit in with us as our own evolution? What is happening to the human being? You know, we've built all these temples and they've got more and more complicated and more geometries being built into them. And yet we seem to be moving away from them. We don't use them as much as we used to. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are cultures that still use them, but we seem to be getting to a condition where people are looking more within themselves to find that and away from temples. Yeah.
But wasn't a temple built like you're saying, the mandala, to help us, you know, connect to the source, to create a sacred space that would be different than the the mundane world, and that would connect us to the sacred sense of ourselves?
Absolutely. And to a certain extent, we can still potentially use them to do that, because it might be the case that it heightens our awareness. But I think that we're realizing that we can call in what those temples were giving us to wherever we are in time and space. And we don't necessarily have to be in those places to call
do
in that.
No, because you think we're evolving as a species, that's true? Or we're devolving? Or, I mean, where are we at as a collective consciousness?
Well, by virtue of the spiral, we're evolving, but what we're evolving into is a mystery in itself, because there's larger and larger numbers of people the humans, we seem to have disconnected ourselves from temples for some reason or another, and yet we still are yearning to make that connection to whatever it is, you know, the consciousness of and the connection of all of us and oneness and all that type of thing. And there must be a reason for that sort of disconnection from temples, whatever that might be. And my view is that the spiritual aspect, if you like, is something that's going to start expanding, but it's going to be much more of something that's very much more personal, as opposed to something that requires us to do something as a group, to go as a community to a temple of some kind or another, and that we can find those attributes of the temple within ourselves, within our own body, and our body is our own temple. You know, there's that phrase that's bandied around quite a bit. And again, we've had this conversation earlier on about, are we sort of reaching the point where matter is going to start contracting and spirit will start expanding? And are we going to change our natures and our forms of being and what we are and turn into something else?
Well, we are doing, it seems like that is happening. The awareness of matter seems to be contracting as this awareness of spirit is expanding. And so it seems to be happening, at least in my reality.
Yeah, definitely. So therefore, if that's the case, I'm sort of thinking, well, what are the implications of that? What does that mean? Is our physical body going to also become less important? Are things around us, is the physical world going to start diminishing in some way? Or are we going to start detaching ourselves from it as we become more spiritual, and is the spiritual connection with each other and with nature and going to become more important in some way? Because I don't have the answer to that. It's something that is happening, and I have a sense that it's happening, but I have no idea what that means to us as a physical, our physical aspects. What that, what does,
well,
that mean? Does that mean there's going to be less animals around? You know, are we suddenly going to see less species? Or
no, what I think it means is that we start to get in touch with subtler feelings of expression. Like, we get more sensitive to other ways of knowing the world that maybe haven't been put into words just yet. There's levels of awareness that seem to be opening up within the human consciousness.
Well, yes, absolutely. And maybe we don't need temples to do that anymore. You see, maybe that's what they're going to start becoming less important. Maybe another aspect of ourselves is going to develop within individuals that allows us to make that connection without having to use a temple or some other tool or other vehicle, or even mandalas for that matter. Maybe we become aware of these shapes and we just know them for what they are, and we accept that. We accept that a circle, for example, represents time, and we don't have to question beyond that to know that that's true. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean. I think it's innate within human consciousness anyway that it is that, you know? But getting to your third book then is the
Gateway Within. Yeah.
Within. Now where do you go in that book?
Right, okay. Well, that really, I do focus on the human alone, our form, the geometry within us. And what we've just been talking about, how do we make the connections? What is chi? What is it about the human and our human evolution and the fact that we go through these phases of development, like, you know, the Piscean Age and the Atlantean Age? Looking back at the other ages, what has that brought to our development, and what is likely to be coming ahead? And
what do you say about that? Tell me.
I haven't finished writing that one, so I can't tell you, can I?
What you've got, just a little preview of what you've got so far.
Well, it really does, it revolve around the fact that we will be making a different types of connections, because we will be more in tune with the energies within our body, and how we create our temple just by sitting, for example, in a triangle and a pyramid. So we're therefore creating our own pyramid. We don't necessarily have to go to one. I can't tell you much more than that, because a lot of these ideas are still formulating, so therefore I might go and say something that I don't want to say, and then, you know, next year I'm going to have to take that back.
is there another book after
there
this?
There is. There's Gateways to Knowing, and whereas Gateways of the Earth and Gateway Within are about 60% done, that one really is. I have notes on that one. That one hasn't taken total shape. I have a general sense of what it's going to be about. But that one is the most more esoteric one of all, because I don't think I haven't been given the knowledge, I haven't finished the research on that, and I'm not quite sure how that one's going to pan out. But that one really is getting less structured. So you have my first one, which is very much about structure and form, and then obviously you get more and more intuitive and gets more and more within yourself. So I'm not quite sure. I know there's a lot to do with stars in there, all the different types of geometric stars that there are, different points, different numbers of how many points they have. And it also links in with a model known as the E8 model. Have you heard of the E8 model?
No. The E8 model? No, I haven't heard of that, no.
Capital E and the number 8.
What is that?
It's a physicist, an American physicist, has put together. He lives, I think he's in California somewhere. He does snowboarding and things. And basically, it's a model which combines lots of theories in quantum physics and mathematical theories. And I don't know if you remember spirographs when you were kids, where you had these little circles and you could
yeah.
sort of stick a pin
yes.
in. It looks like you've gone mad with spirographs and done loads and loads and loads of them. Absolutely beautiful image. If you just put E8 into and do a search on it, you'll see this model is lovely. And it looks like a mandala with lots and lots and lots of these spirograph patterns within it. And if you look at it, you can see different star patterns forming within it. So I know in some ways my fourth book is connected in with that E8 model, but I'm not quite sure how yet. I'm just getting some insights into that at the moment.
So would that be sort of like a chaos theory sort of it all and
yeah.
in a way how creation is ongoing also?
It is, because, for example, if you have a circle and you have a square, now draw 400 squares, just rotating each square slightly every time.
Yeah.
And then you have one pattern, one level. Now you take a triangle and do the same thing, just rotating
yeah.
it slightly every time. Can you see how you're getting those patterns forming?
Patterns overlaying other patterns.
Exactly, and you overlay all of them.
Uh-huh.
And that gives you an idea of what the E8 model looks like. So I know in some way basic shapes are connected into that, and I've got to make that connection yet.
Do you ever talk about the fractal patterns, the Mandelbrot set?
I do in the next one, Gateways of the Earth. I touch on that one.
Uh-huh.
Touch on fractals.
So, if we could sum it all up, what does it mean? I mean, how do shapes affect our reality? Just the shapes around us in the very room that we're in. How does it affect the reality?
Well, shapes contain things by virtue of, they bound it. And by virtue of what shape it is, the nature of the energy within the boundaries changes, and that's why temple designs are done as they are, why they are specific shapes and very precise ones as well sometimes, because you're containing, you're creating a sort of energy within them. So from the beginning, the premise is that shapes allow us to come into reality and to inhabit it, to inhabit time and space. They give time and space and things like that a form. They give it some kind of structure so that we can use it and we can work with it. And when you take one of those shapes by itself, you can actually work with the energy with it to understand better the nature of space or time or whatever. To link in with it, and you do that through intent. If you just use shapes without any intent and just randomly, then it's sort of functional, just like making a table. Even though you would make a table in a particular way and it's square, it's not necessarily going to be hexagonal for whatever reason. When you start to use these shapes deliberately, you're harnessing the energy. And I think what more and more people are doing is they're suddenly becoming aware of geometry, and they're saying, well, hang on a minute, why do I keep seeing these shapes and what does it mean? And I'm just trying to turn some buttons on and say, well, that's to do with space and time, and let's sense the energy and see what it means. And it just raises people's awareness then.
Mm.
They tune more into the fact, what we're saying, that consciousness is there. There's more to this than makes us, heightens our sensory perception.
Right.
In some way, allows the connections that you're making, that we make, to become more present in our lives, as opposed to desensitizing us from reality and just we just walk around and we do our jobs. We become more present, more aware, and start to use these with intent, just like in meditation. You actually have to consciously decide you're going to do that and then do it. Do you know what I mean? So it's just making people aware of these energies and what they're about, and maybe they'll start to actually tune into it and then start to use them themselves in whatever it is they do. For example,
in a sense, throughout this whole conversation, I would say that what you're describing is sort of the blueprints to creation and sort of what Einstein said, the mind of God, you know?
Mm.
Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that. Yes, it is the blueprint of creation, and therefore it is in everything that we do, how we organize ourselves socially, when we make anything, when we do anything. In there somewhere is this blueprint.
It's a blueprint, but they also have power. You know, like you said, the five-pointed star has a power and a magic to it as well.
Absolutely, yes. Yes, well, that's
why does it have a magic to it for the five-pointed star, for instance?
The five-pointed star. Well, that's links and ties into the elements. So you have the five elements, and that's the 5 points. That's about combining things. In fact, the word, you use the word magic there because it is associated with magic, the pentagram.
Yeah.
Because what you're doing with magic is you're combining things in different ways to change reality, to change the condition of beings who turn one thing into another thing. Through magic, through invocation of symbols or whatever. So the five is the magic of nature, really. The magic of the elements combining in different ways. Just as we humans are made up of the five elements, you know, we have water, we have earth, we have warmth, we have the fire aspect within us, and we have air, we breathe air. So we are... we have this magic, you know, we've been created out of this magic, the combination of the elements in different ways.
But they seem to work, this ideas of certain symbols affecting, you know, if we put, you know, a five-pointed star or something in the kind of Wicca magic tradition, it empowers something.
That's,
right?
yes.
How is that? Yeah.
Well, it's true for whatever the any shapes, any symbols, when you're using them with intent, you're harnessing their energy, harnessing their power. So with circles, you know, when we get into meditation circles, what we're doing is we're connecting with other people in the moment in time. You're making a different connection with everybody and creating a different energy than if you were to sit in a square, or whether you were to draw out the five-pointed star and have five people sitting on the star. You're saying, you're calling in that energy. And that, again, has been done throughout different cultures, like in calling in the four winds. You know, you draw a circle and you're calling in the energy of the four winds. Or if you, three of you, were to sit in a triangle and use the energy of the triangle, or a combination of different shapes. The word magic is appropriate because what you're doing is you're using the energies of these different things, just like you do in mandalas. It's exactly the same principle, and that's why they're the equivalent of magic in Asia. You know, you're putting together these geometric patterns and invoking their energy, invoking their power.
Because when you talk about intent, would you say that these basic shapes has the intent of creation built into it?
That's right. Yes, because it's, as you say, it's the blueprint of the universe. So when you're using sacred geometry, you're working with the fabric of the universe. You're trying to alter structures in reality. You're trying to alter reality. You're working with the fabric of reality. Sometimes to your own intent, you're trying to change it because you want something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're...
So if these shapes have this basic intent of... from creation itself, and when we line up with that intent and in a way use it for our own ego purposes, we somehow walk that very fine line between my will and thy will. You know?
Exactly, yes, you do, indeed. And that's where it gets down to, it's not necessarily going to work unless it's meant to. Yeah, it is, exactly. Where's the fine line between... will these work anyway? Do you know what I mean? Is this something going to manifest just because you want it and you use this, or is it only going to manifest because your intent is correct? And what is the right intent? That's another whole area that you could talk about for quite a long time as well.
Right. I mean, we can continue this conversation at some point, but I think that last piece was, I was sort of getting what you meant by intent and how these basic shames have really an inherent cosmic universal mind intent with them, and if we use those shapes in accordance consciously with the importance of the intent that they already have, it empowers us even further with the intent that we can have.
Exactly, yes. And that's the magic.
I see. So it's working with the elements of creation to empower the human being to be more of who they can be.
Exactly, more of who they can be, which then raises their evolution, which is what we were talking about earlier today, and it's facilitating our evolution.
So we're working with nature and these shapes, which are nature, to facilitate an evolution in a conscious way, and that's why these sacred geometric forms are so important to us.
They are, yes. And why so many people, like I've come across so many people saying, I keep seeing triangles all of a sudden, why is that? They're sort of coming into our awareness again. They're becoming, you know, we're being drawn back to them again.
Mm. And that's maybe why these crop circles are becoming so much more well known, because they use these circles.
Absolutely.
And they somehow, if we could truly understand what they're saying, give us a greater empowerment.
Absolutely. But that empowerment is becoming more and more intuitive, because it's a language. The crop circles are a language, just as we use symbols in our languages.
But we don't know what the language means. We can only...
No, we don't know, because it's not something that we've created. It's a foreign, completely foreign language, yes.
But yet the symbols are common to our... unconscious psyche, our mind on a deeper level.
Absolutely. And that's why I think to really understand whatever is being said, you have to sort of tune into it, just as we would as a mandala, because it's the same symbols that we would use in a mandala. So we have to link into it in a different way to read it, to be at one with it, if you know what I mean.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I would love to do as the crop circle season unfolds this year, probably the end of April, I'd love to just call you up and have you do a tuning in interpretation of the latest crop circle and what you think they mean.
Certainly, yes, because I know one or two people that are always out there looking for the latest crop circle. So, yes, that would be a very interesting experience.
Yeah, because you've really looked at shapes, and I think you have a very deep intuitive understanding of what they do mean. So I'd be very interested in seeing what your impressions of these new forms as they appear are saying.
That'd be great. That'd be very interesting, actually. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Karen. Well,
thank you very much, Alan.
I know it was a bit of a lengthy... I hope you're not too tired. I know you just flew in yesterday to New York.
Yes, well, my brain is still functioning, just about.
Well, I think you did really well.
Thank you very much.
Karen French will be at the New Life Expo this weekend in Manhattan at the New Yorker Hotel, 34th and 8th. What day are you speaking there?
I'm speaking on Saturday afternoon. And on Sunday morning, I'm doing a two-hour workshop at about 11 o'clock, I think it is.
Okay. Well, thank you again for being
a guest.
Yeah. And your website is what again?
It's gatewaytotheheavens.com.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Alan. I look forward to speaking to you again.
Okay. Thank you. I've been talking to Karen French. My name is Alan Steinfeld, and Karen's the author of Gateway to the Heavens. My website is newrealities.com, and you can email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. And take a look at my website, because I have some interesting events coming up.
I'll also be at the New Life Expo this weekend on Sunday, and that's posted on my website. Thank you for listening.
There is no sadness, only joy.